Welcome to the September 2015 issue of Dialogues in Dermatology. The American Academy of Dermatology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This activity is certified for two AMA PRA Category 1 credits. The date of original release for this issue is September 2015. The expiration date is August 2018. At the conclusion of this learning activity, participants should be able to identify components of the Medicare fraud and abuse laws, identify methods to reduce errors in practice, and identify strategies to avoid diagnostic errors. A full list of financial relationships with commercial interests reported by editors, interviewees, reviewers, and staff is available in the syllabus.
Welcome back to Dialogues in Dermatology. This is Terry Cronin, your editor-in-chief. This is Dialogues in Dermatology for September 2015, Volume 71, Issue 9. I hope you're having a wonderful summer and protecting yourself from the sun. Remember to download the fabulous new Dialogues in Dermatology app for your smartphone and computer. This convenient app is making dialogues even more accessible and enjoyable while effectively providing CMEs for you. In this month's edition, we have three new dialogues involving medical legal issues and learning from medical errors. Now more than ever, there are so many legal issues that affect time-strapped physicians who possess little formal legal training and lack a complete understanding of the implications these many regulations could have on their careers and practice. In this dialogue, Dr. Jane Yu and President-elect of the AAD, Dr. Abel Torres, discuss a vast amount of new information on how to protect yourself and your practice from potential legal problems. Dr. Torres, who also holds a law degree, provides his expert advice on medical legal issues.
Hello, this is Jane Yu for Dialogues in Dermatology, and today I have the distinct pleasure of interviewing Dr. Abel Torres. Dr. Torres is professor and chairman of Loma Linda University School of Medicine, Department of Dermatology, as well as professor and chairman of Case Western Reserve University Metro Health Systems Department of Dermatology. He's also a lawyer. Welcome, Dr. Torres.
Thank you for having me here.
A lot of our members are interested in learning about the medical legal issues in dermatology, especially because they've been trained in medicine for such a long period of time, but don't have any legal background. Can you comment on the Medicare fraud and abuse laws?
Sure. So the Medicare fraud and abuse laws basically comprise, one, the False Claims Act, two, the Anti-Kickback Statute, three, the Physician Self-Referral Act, commonly known as the Stark Laws, four, the Exclusion Statute, and five, the Civil Monetary Penalty Law. So these are enforced by the Department of Justice, the Office of the Inspector General in the Department of Health and Human Services, and lastly, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or what's commonly known as CMS.
Oh, terrific. So can you tell us a little bit more about the False Claims Act? I've never heard of that.
So the False Claims Act, also known as the Civil False Claims Act, or some people call it the FCA, prohibits individuals and businesses from submitting or causing someone else to submit a false or fraudulent claim for payment to the government. It applies to all government programs, including Medicare. Now, the two most common violations of the False Claims Act are basically what we call submission of false claims to the government and the fabrication of records to get a false claim paid. So breaches of the False Claim Act can result in fines of up to three times the program loss, plus $11,000 per claim filed. So the other thing that's interesting is that now under the Affordable Care Act, a violation of what's called the Anti-Kickback Statute, which we can talk about later, is also deemed a false claim as well. So a physician can now basically have penalties both for both of those laws, from just one single claim. And the interesting part about this is that neither of these claims have to be with an intent by the physician to defraud. It just has to be that the physician knows, and knows or knowing is defined basically as the physician having tangible knowledge that the law exists or a disregard for the information about the law. So in other words, ignorance under the law is no excuse for the physician. They have to be aware of the law. Even if they didn't intend to defraud, if they violate the law, they will be deemed to have been knowing and violated the law.
That's pretty sneaky there.
It is. Yeah. And then it goes a step beyond that, because the other thing is that this Civil False Claims Act also has what's called a QI TAM, or whistleblowing provision. And this stems back basically from the Civil War. What happened is that during the Civil War, there were different contractors supplying weapons to the Army. And some of those guns were faulty, the ammunition was faulty, and there was fraud going on. So the government wanted some way to basically catch this fraud. And so they had this whistleblowing provision that if somebody could go ahead and tell the government what was going on, then they would be able to share in any recovery that the government could do. So in essence, what the KeyTAM Act or whistleblowing statute does is it allows a person that's a non-government affiliated individual to file a claim on behalf of the government against the individual, and then they will get a certain percentage of the proceeds that the government recovers from them. So if a physician is accused of fraud, and let's say a member of his staff or a patient or somebody else feels that this was a fraud, they will file that claim. And if the government sees merit in that claim, then under those circumstances, they may be able to recover part of the collections that get found by the government.
Oh, wow. That's definitely an incentive for people working in your office or patients. And thanks so much about bringing the history into that, because I had no idea about all that was involved with the Civil War. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the exclusion statute?
So the exclusion statute basically says that a physician who's convicted of a criminal offense, for example, Medicare fraud, which can be either a misdemeanor or a felony conviction, or a physician who's convicted of things like patient abuse and neglect or illegal distribution of a controlled substance, they can be banned from participating in Medicare by the Office of the Inspector General. And physicians who are excluded may not directly or indirectly bill the federal government for services that they provide to any Medicare patients. Now, what's significant about that, though, is that it's not just that the physician is excluded, but if you are a practice that's going to employ a physician, or you're a physician that's going to hire a physician for your practice, basically, you're not allowed to employ or contract with an excluded physician or entity if it is possible that the services that those individuals are going to furnish could be billed to Medicare. And to ensure this, what physicians or practices have to do is that they should go into the Office of the Inspector General's online database to make sure that the people they're hiring are not excluded.
That's interesting. I never knew about that. Is there a specific time period that's involved with that as well? Or
so the answer is yes, but it just depends on the penalty. It depends on the reason for the exclusion. So that's basically on an individual basis.
And now that you alluded to this, what is the difference between the anti-kickback statute and the physician self-referral statute?
So the anti-kickback statute basically is a criminal law, and it prohibits individuals or companies basically from either looking for, receiving, or offering remuneration, right, in exchange for referring patients, or also in exchange for receiving services paid by the government.
Mm-hmm. How does this often happen in dermatology, or how would it happen in dermatology, for instance?
So a good example might be things like meals or lodging that somebody gets if they refer somebody, money for referring patients. So let's say a hospital says, or some group says, look, if you send us these patients, we'll give you a percentage of whatever it is that we generate by having those patients come to us.
Okay, I see. And is there any way to avoid the anti-kickback statute and the physician self-referral statute? Because it seems a little bit complicated given how things are structured these days.
So there's a couple of things that are important. Number one is, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier, and that is that it's not just that you get money. It could also be things like benefits, like a meal or a lodging or some other kind of benefit. So physicians have to be very careful anytime they're getting any kind of a benefit. If in any way that is related to some kind of referral, that could be a situation that puts them at peril. And so they have to be in heightened awareness of that possibility. The other thing that's important is that the government doesn't have to demonstrate that it actually loses money as a result of the referral. So for example, some people might say, well, the service would have been prescribed with or without the referral, so therefore no violation occurred. Not true. As far as the government is concerned, it doesn't matter if they would have paid for that service or not, What's the problem is that if you receive some kind of a kickback as a result of that referral, then that's going to be deemed a violation whether or not the patient would have received that service anyway. Now, there are what they call quote-unquote safe harbors, and these safe harbors exist for physicians who basically would be in a practice that would otherwise constitute a violation. So, for example, what are we talking about? Well, a physician may lease space, they may rent equipment, or they may be selling a practice to a hospital, for example, or to an entity. And that might be considered kind of a kickback, because if they're renting space in the hospital or with that entity and they're seeing patients, the question is that kind of a quid pro quo that's going on? But what basically happens is, as long as those things are done at what we call an arm's length transaction, which means that it's done basically for the fair market value of what that service would cost, and there's a written contract that kind of outlines the details of it, then that's considered to be one of those quote-unquote safe harbors. But still, it gets a little tricky and confusing, so it's advisable for a physician to make sure that they have an attorney who basically specializes in this area to make sure that whatever they're doing is within one of those safe harbors.
That definitely makes sense.
And you also mentioned earlier about the Self-Referral Act.
Yes.
And so that's different than the Anti-Kickback Statute. The Physician Self-Referral Act, which is commonly known as the Stark Law, because that was the person who basically proposed it, governs the practice of referring a patient to receive a service or a visit to a facility in which that physician has a financial interest. Okay? So, for example, a physician could be a part owner of a hospital or a part owner of some kind of a service like a magnetic resonance or imaging center or a laboratory of some sort. So under those circumstances, for example, if the patient is referring the patient and the patient goes there and the physician is going to receive a part of the proceeds of that referral, then that's considered to be a violation under the Self-Referral Act. There are, however, exceptions to that, and basically those exceptions, they're actually outlined under the law, and they have about 11 designated services in that case, of which one of those that's very important for dermatology is what's called the in-office ancillary exception. And that's very important because that allows a physician to either own an imaging, a laboratory, or other types of ancillary facilities if they participate in a group practice. So if they're part of a group practice and there is that in-office ancillary exception, then the physician is basically protected.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you for that clarification. And moving on, what about the civil monetary penalties laws?
I can answer that, but before I answer that, maybe I could tell you something a little bit about what qualifies as a group practice to make sure that people understand that. So the government gives you specifications about that. And they basically say that in order to qualify for that in-office ancillary exception in a group practice type of sense, it has to be a single legal entity. It has to have at least two physicians who are members of the group, okay? Each physician basically has to furnish substantially the full range of patient care services, and at least 75% of the total patient care services must be furnished through the group and billed under the group, under their billing number assigned to the group. The income from the practices has to be distributed according to the methods that are determined before the receipt of payment for those services to the lab or the service that occurs. So in other words, what they're saying is it can't be that you get a direct percentage of what's going to that lab as basically being your salary, but basically it can be part of the overall process, but it can't be something that's specifically like that.
So it's more indirect then.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then lastly, the members of the group have to personally conduct no less than 75% of the physician-patient encounters in the group practice. So that's important for physicians to understand because office ancillary exception is very important for us in dermatology.
Right, of course.
But we need to understand what the limitations are there. So for people, especially young physicians going into a practice, they should really kind of question this, find out exactly what's going on in that practice. And if they have any question, talk to an attorney that has experience in this area to kind of guide them and make sure that it's done properly.
Great. Is there a way to get more information about these specific laws or about the group practices and the stipulations that you just mentioned?
So it's actually not hard to get this information at all. Basically, if somebody goes on Google and they look up these specific laws. There are plenty of sites that come up that will go ahead and give information about the laws. In addition, the OIG has a website, and if they look up the OIG, there will be a website in there that gives them a lot of information as it relates to fraud and abuse and the different laws. They even have a watch list that they have there. So the physician can go on there and find out that they're number one on that list.
Oh, my.
So that would be an important thing to do as well.
That's interesting. Okay, so can you tell us about the Civil Monetary Penalties Law?
Sure. So the Civil Monetary Penalties Law basically is under the Social Security Act that basically authorizes that the Health and Human Services can seek civil monetary penalties and exclusion for certain behaviors by a practitioner. These penalties are basically enforced through the Office of the Inspector General, otherwise known as the OIG, and it's through this process called the CMP, or the Civil Monetary Penalties Law. So, for example, a physician can incur a CMP, a civil monetary penalty, by presenting or causing claims to be presented to a federal healthcare program that the person knows or should know, and that goes back to that thing that we talked about knowing, for an item or service that was provided, that was not provided, rather, as opposed to provided, or that was false or fraudulent, right? It also could be if they violated the anti-kickback statute, okay, either by offering to pay or by receiving basically remuneration in return for referrals, right? Or if they knowingly present or cause claims to be presented that violate the Stark Law. So basically the CMP applies to the Stark Law, the anti-kickback law, and what we commonly talk about, fraud and abuse, in terms of fraudulent claims.
And is there a heavy fine that's incurred for like one particular statute versus another?
So as we talked about before, for example, each one of them has their own penalties. Some of them have criminal penalties. Some of them have monetary penalties. And early on when we talked about in terms of the fraud and abuse laws, what happens is they will look and see if there's an incident, and they could charge up to like $11,000 per incident or more, depending on how the law changes. What does that mean? It means, for example, let's say that you submit a claim. The government deems that claim was fraud or abuse, and it was for a specific type of service. The government says, okay, that's $11,000 for that claim. But then the government says, well, how often did that occur? And so they'll look at your records and they'll say, in an average week, you see so many patients and you bill for this kind of services X number of times. And then they'll say, well, then that's what happens in an average week. Now let's say how many times in a year that would be expected to occur. And so the next thing you know, it's not $11,000.
No,
you could be talking millions of dollars in terms of what the average is. And the burden of proof is on the physician to prove that it didn't happen. The government just simply has to say, this is what we think happened. You prove to us it didn't happen.
And like you said before, it could be something innocuous that the physician really didn't intend for it to happen.
Correct. And that's the big part, that it doesn't have to be intentional. That's why physicians have to be aware of these laws and be careful.
Thank you for providing us with this wonderful information so our members can learn more about medical legal issues in dermatology.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure to be here today.
While little to no formal legal education occurs for most dermatologists, there are several laws and regulations of considerable importance to the practice of dermatology. Two major legal issues covered herein are laws pertaining to Medicare fraud and abuse, as well as the fundamental principles of medical malpractice. According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, healthcare fraud is estimated to range in the billions of dollars per year, which places unnecessary burden on taxpayers and compromises the care of Medicare beneficiaries. By definition, fraud is knowingly submitting false claims or making misrepresentations to obtain a federal healthcare payment, whereas abuse is any practice that is not consistent with the goals of providing patients with services that are medically necessary, meet professionally recognized standards, or priced fairly. Dermatologists, along with all physicians, must comply with the False Claims Act, the Anti-Kickback Statute, the Physician Self-Referral Act, and the Exclusion Statute, which together make up the majority of Medicare fraud and abuse laws. The False Claims Act, or FCA, as applied to healthcare, prohibits individuals and businesses from submitting or having others submit false or fraudulent claims for payment to the government. Frequent modes of violation include submitting false claims or the falsification of records to obtain federal payment. Under the law, offenders may incur fines of 3 times the amount of the violation, plus $11,000 per claim filed. Additionally, the law has a, quote, whistleblower, end quote, provision that allows individuals, including patients, employees, and or co-workers, to bring charges and be eligible to collect a portion of any government recovery. Unfortunately, the FCA does not require proof of intent to defraud for a violation to occur, assumes that physicians participating in Medicare are familiar with the law, and lays the burden of proof with the accused in these cases. Beyond this, individuals convicted of Medicare fraud or a criminal offense such as patient abuse or distribution of controlled substances can be prohibited from participating in Medicare under the exclusion statute. In fact, physicians must access a database on the Office of the Inspector General website to determine if they or a colleague are an excluded individual in order to avoid further fines. This is especially important when hiring new physicians into a practice that participates in Medicare. The Anti-Kickback Statute, or AKS, is a federal policy criminalizing individuals or businesses from seeking, receiving, or offering payment or compensation in exchange for referring patients for services paid for by the government. The government is not required to prove a financial loss to bring charges against an individual, and can even accuse doctors when the compensation received was for a referral for a necessary service. Now, under the Affordable Care Act, physicians accused of violating the AKS are also simultaneously deemed to be in violation of the FCA. A related law, known commonly as the Stark Law, is the Physician Self-Referral Act, which prohibits physicians from referring a patient for services at a facility in which the physician has a financial interest. An important exception to this rule applicable to dermatologists is the in-office ancillary exception. Under this exception, a dermatology group practice can refer internally for services such as dermatopathology without violating the Stark Law. The in-office ancillary exception has been targeted by the Government Accountability Office as the cause for increased internal referrals and rising healthcare costs, yet efforts to narrow the exception have largely been unsuccessful. Medical malpractice has long been a concern for dermatologists, yet few have a working understanding of its components. For a plaintiff to win a medical malpractice case, they must establish 5 elements, which include 1, a legal medical duty was owed, 2, the duty was breached by the provider, 3, the breach of duty was a direct and proximate cause of injury, 4, the provider deviated from the accepted standards of care for the profession, and 5, that damages either financial or emotional occurred. In a recent review of medical professional liability claims in a large voluntary database, it was found that 1.1% of claims were against dermatologists, with an average indemnity payment of more than $130,000 per claim. The most common cause for allegations in the analysis was improper procedure performance related to skin surgery. The second most common cause for allegations were errors in diagnosis, especially related to malignant melanoma, which carried an average indemnity payment in excess of $400,000. With regards to cases against Mohs surgeons, a recent study showed that the majority of lawsuits were raised due to a lack of proper informed consent and cosmetic outcome issues, yet fewer than 7% of judgments went to the plaintiff. Repeatedly, studies have shown that one of the greatest motivators of malpractice proceedings are weaknesses in the doctor-patient relationship, especially in terms of communication. An important rule of thumb to avoid trouble should be to always put the patient's interests first, establish a strong doctor-patient relationship, and to be honest and diligent with all billing claims made to Medicare.